The Personal History of David Copperfield by Charles Dickens.
In language whose excess imparts the power they feel so well, there may perhaps in such a scene some recollection be.
Part 2. I begin life on my own account.
Of days that heaven's happy been, and you remember me.
This is a new term. Take care what you're about. Come fresh up to lessons, for I come fresh up to the punishment. The marks I shall give you won't rub out, however hard you rub them. Now, get to work, every one of you. Copperfield.
Sir?
You're famous for biting, but I'm famous for biting, too. What's that?
It's a cane, sir.
No, Copperfield. It's a tooth. Is it a sharp tooth? Hey, does it bite? Hey, do you hear me, Copperfield? Does it bite?
I was soon in tears, but I was not alone. Half the school was crying before the day's work began. Steerforth had continued his protection of me and proved a useful ally, since nobody dared to annoy anyone he honored with his friendship. For my part, I admired him very much and felt a great pride and satisfaction when an accidental circumstance enabled me to be of service to him.
Copperfield. Copperfield.
Yes, Steerforth.
You're not asleep, then? Good. You usually sleep well enough. I don't. Not often. That book you were talking about today, what was it called?
What book, sir?
Some novel. You said Travers reminded you of the hero.
Roderick at Random.
That was it. A novel by... Who was it?
Tobias Smollett. We've got all his books at home.
Smollett, yes. Have you got any of them with you?
No.
Can you remember them?
Oh, yes. I know them all very well. And I think I've got a good memory.
Now, I tell you what. You should tell them to me. I told you, I can't get to sleep at night, and I wake early. We'll make a regular Arabian Nights of it, and you can start with Roderick Random.
And so Roderick offered to stand the West Indies was made surgeon's mate on board the Lizard Man of War.
Come on, young Copperfield. You're half asleep. We'll have the rest another time.
Thank you, Steerforth.
You could go to sleep in class tomorrow morning if you cared to. It's only old Mel. And nobody minds him.
Why? Why don't they mind him?
Because he's a poor thing.
He was very kind to me in the holidays, and he met me when my coach arrived in London and looked after me.
Looked after you? How?
He took me to a place where an old lady cooked breakfast for me.
That was uncommonly kind of her. A friend of Mel's, was she?
I suppose so. She called him My Charlie.
Did she indeed? What sort of place was it?
A little cottage. One of a lot of cottages. There was a stone over the gate. It said, They were established for 25 poor women.
Well, you know who she was, don't you?
No.
Mel's mother. Mel's mother, living on charity. I don't suppose Creakle knows about it.
Tyrant! This is impossible! How can you do this, boys? Silence, Mr. Steerforth.
Silence yourself. Whom are you talking to?
Sit down.
Sit down yourself and mind your business.
If you think I don't know the power you can establish over any mind here, or that I haven't seen you urging your juniors on to every sort of outrage against me, you're mistaken.
I don't give myself the trouble of thinking about you at all. So I'm not mistaken.
Now, when you use your position of favoritism here to insult a gentleman...
Oh, what? Where is he?
Shame, J. Steerforth. Too bad.
Be quiet, Traddles. To insult one who is not fortunate in life and who never gave you the least offence when you were old enough and wise enough to know the many reasons for not insulting him. When you do this, I say you commit a mean and base action.
Mr. Mel, once for all, when you take the liberty of calling me mean and base, you're an impudent beggar. You're always a beggar, you know. But when you do that, you're an impudent beggar.
Sinful!
Mr. Mel?
Sir?
You have not forgotten yourself, I hope.
No, sir.
And Mr. Steerforth?
Sir?
What is this?
What did he mean by talking about favorites?
Favorites? Who talked about favorites?
He did.
Pray, what did you mean by that, sir?
I meant, Mr. Creakle, that no pupil has a right to avail himself of his position of favoritism to degrade me.
He said I was mean, and then he said I was base, and then I called him a beggar.
I am surprised you should attach such an epithet to anyone employed at Salem House. That's not an answer, sir.
Let him deny it.
Deny that he's a beggar.
If he's not a beggar himself, his near relation is one. His mother lives on charity in an almshouse.
Now you'll hear what this gentleman says, Mr. Mel. Have the goodness to set him right.
He is right, sir. What he says is true.
Indeed.
Yes. You know my worldly circumstances are not good. You know what my position is here.
I know that you've been in a wrong position altogether and mistook this for a charity school. Mr. Mel, we'll part, if you please. The sooner the better.
There's no time like the present.
Sir, Keo.
I take my leave of you, Mr. Creakle. And all of you. James Steerforth, the best wish I can leave you is that you may come to be ashamed of what you've done today.
Mm-hmm. Steerforth, you have asserted the independence and respectability of Salem House. Let me shake your hand.
Sir.
Thomas Traddles, come here. What is this nonsense? Now you really have something to cry about. Boys, get on with your work.
What are you blubbing for, Travels? I'm glad you caught it.
I don't care. Mr. Mel was ill-used.
Who ill-used him, you girl?
Why, you did.
What have I done?
What have you done? Hurt his feelings and locked him in his situation.
His feelings? They'll soon get the better of it. They're not like your feelings, Miss Traddles. As for his situation, do you suppose I'm not going to write home and take care he gets some money, Polly?
I remember we all thought this very noble of Steerforth, whose mother was a rich widow, reputed to do almost anything he asked her. One afternoon a few weeks later, I was summoned to the dining room and told I had visitors. I went there feeling very nervous. I could only think of Mr. and Miss Murdstone. But when I opened the door, I saw two very different faces.
Why, Mr. Peggotty and Ham.
Master Davy.
Master Davy, oh, you grown.
Am I grown?
Grown, Master Davy? And he grown.
Do you know how Mama is? And my dear old Peggotty?
She's uncommon, common.
And Mrs. Gummidge and little Emily?
Uncommon. We brought these here for you, Master Davy.
Shrimps! Oh, thank you.
And a lobster or two. Knowing as how you was partial to a little relish with your victuals when you was along at us. The old mother biled them, she did.
Thank you, Mr. Peggotty. And please thank Mrs. Gummidge.
All that I will, sir.
I suppose little Emily's grown now, since I saw her.
She is getting to be a woman. That's what she's getting to be. Her pretty face.
Her learning.
Her writing. Why, that's black as jet. And so large it is, you might see it anywhere.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you were here, young Copperfield.
Don't go, Steerforth, if you please. These are two Yarmouth boatmen. Mm-hmm. Very kind, good people. Relations of my nurse. Who've come from Gravesend to see me.
Aye, aye. I'm glad to see them. How are you both?
Uncommon, sir.
You must let them know at home, if you please, Mr. Peggotty, that Mr. Steerforth is very kind to me, and that I don't know what I should do here without them.
Nonsense. You mustn't tell them anything of the sort.
And if Mr. Steerforth ever comes into Norfolk or Suffolk, I shall bring him to Yarmouth, if he lets me, to see your house. It's made out of a boat, Steerforth.
Made out of a boat, is it?
Huh?
That's the right sort of house for such a thorough-built boatman.
So it is, huh? So it is. The young gentleman's right, a thorough-built boatman, that's right. Yes.
I thank you, sir. I do my endeavours in my line of life.
The best of us can do no more, Mr. Peggotty.
I'll pound it, sir. That's what you do yourself, and what you do right well. Now, my house and mine, sir. But there's hearty at your service. If you should come along with Master Davy to see it, I wish you both well, and I wish you happy.
We parted from them in the warmest fashion. They had opened their hearts to Steerforth. Indeed, there was an ease in his manner and a charm in his voice and his handsome face that carried a kind of enchantment with it that few people could resist. At last, the holidays came, and the Yarmouth coach, and then Mr. Barkis, the carrier, taking me home again.
Get up there!
You look very well, Mr. Barkis. I gave your message. I did write to Peggotty.
What?
Wasn't that right?
Why, no.
Not the message?
The message was right enough, prompt. But it come to an end there. Nothing come of it.
There was an answer expected, was there?
When a man says he's willing, it's as much as to say that that there man's waiting for an answer.
Well, Mr. Barkis?
Well, that there man's been waiting for an answer ever since.
Have you told her so, Mr. Barkis?
No. We ain't got no call to go and tell her so. We never say six words to her myself.
Would you like me to do it?
You might tell her, if you would, that Barkis is waiting for an answer. What's her name?
Peggotty.
Christian name or natural name?
Oh, it's not her Christian name. Her Christian name is Clara.
Is it, though? Oh. See here. We'll write it on the card. Clara Peggotty. Well, says you, Peggotty, Barkis is waiting for an answer. Says she, perhaps, answer the what? Says you to what I told you. What is that, says she? Barkis is willing, says you. Cheer up!
Soon I was at our house, where the bare old elm trees wrung their many hands in the bleak wintry air. and strands of the old rooks' nests drifted away upon the wind. I went in with a quiet, timid step. It was my mother's voice. I think I must have lain in her arms and heard her singing to me when I was a baby. It filled my heart brim full, like a friend come back after a long absence.
Mother's love slumbers, not watching or being.
She was sitting by the fire, suckling an infant, whose tiny hand she held against her neck. Her eyes were looking down upon its face.
Mama!
Davy! My dearest Davy! My own boy!
She kissed me and laid my head down on her breast Davy. Near the little creature that was nestling there and put its hand to my lips.
He is your brother. Davy, my pretty boy. My poor child.
I wish I had died then, with that feeling in my heart. I should have been more fit for heaven than I have ever been since. It seemed that Mr. and Miss Murdstone had gone out on a visit and would not return before night. We dined together by the fireside, Peggotty, my mother and I, as if the old days were come back.
Peggotty? I've got a message for you from Mr. Barkis.
From Barkis, Master Davy?
Yes. He asked me to tell you again. Barkis is willing.
Oh, no, he never did no such thing.
Yes, he did. He said, Barkis is willing.
Peggotty, you ridiculous thing. What's the matter?
Drat the man. He wants to marry me. Barkis wants to marry me.
It would be a very good match for you, perhaps.
I wouldn't have him if he were made of gold, nor I wouldn't have nobody.
Will you tell him so?
Well, he never said a word to me about it. He know better. If he were to make so bold to say a word to me, I should slap his face.
So you're not going to be married, Peggotty dear?
Oh, Lord bless you, no, ma'am.
Don't leave me, Peggotty. Stay with me. It may not be for long.
Me leave you, my precious. Not for all the world and his wife. Why, what's put that in your silly little head? I'll stay with you till I'm a cross, cranky old woman. And when I'm too deaf and too mumbly for want of teeth to be any use at all, then I shall go to my Davy and ask him to take me in.
And I'll make you as welcome as a queen.
Bless you, dear. I know you will.
Come, my baby.
I wonder what's become of Davy's great aunt.
Miss Trotwood, is that who you mean, Peggotty?
Yes, Master Davy, your aunt, Betsy Trotwood. I wonder if she'd have died, whether she'd leave Davy anything.
Oh, good gracious, Peggotty. You know she took offence at poor Davy's being born at all.
She might favour him more now. Now he's got a brother.
Peggotty! As if this poor little innocent in his cradle ever did you any harm. You'd better go and marry Mr. Barkis.
Oh, I'd make Miss Murdstone happy if I was to.
You know she only does what she does out of kindness and the best intentions.
Yeah, there's too much of the best intentions going on.
When you talk of Mr. Murdstone's good intentions...
I never talked of them.
You must know how good his intentions are. If he seems to have been at all stern with a certain person... It's for a certain person's own good. He loves a certain person on my account. And he takes great pains with me, and I ought to be very thankful to him.
Well, that's as may be.
Oh, Peggotty, don't let us fall out, for I couldn't bear it. You are my true friend, if I have any in the world.
Fall out, my pretty. Peggotty, you'll never fall out with you. I'd like to see her try, eh, Davy?
I felt that evening as though the old days were back. I crept close to my mother's side and sat as I used to, with my arms round her and my cheek on her shoulder. I felt her beautiful hair drooping over me like an angel's wing and was very happy indeed. Even then I saw that she was changed. Her face was very pretty still, but it was careworn and delicate. And her hand was so thin and white, it seemed almost transparent. But I was too young to wonder what the reason for this change might be. Next morning, I had to meet the Murdstones again, and the happy time was over.
Davy, dear.
I beg your pardon, sir. I'm very sorry for what I did, and I hope you will forgive me.
I'm glad to hear you're sorry, David.
Dear me, how long are the holidays?
A month, ma'am.
Counting from when?
From today, ma'am.
Oh. Then here's one day off.
Mama?
Yes, Davy?
Can I hold my baby brother just for a moment?
Why, take him, dearest.
Oh, he's so tiny.
Yes.
Oh! Good heavens! Clara! You see?
See what, my dear Jane?
Got it. The boy has got the baby. Come here. Quiet. Quiet. You're with me now. Oh, I feel quite faint. Take him, Clara. Boy, never do that again. You must never touch the baby.
No doubt you're right, my dear Jane.
David, where are you going?
I was going to talk to Peggotty.
You will stay here.
Oh.
I'm sorry to observe you're of a sullen disposition.
As sulky as a bear.
Now, David, a sullen, obdurate disposition is of all tempers the worst.
And of all such dispositions I've ever seen, this boy's is the most stubborn.
Oh.
Even you must see it, Clara.
I beg your pardon, my dear Jane, but are you quite sure... Oh, forgive me. But are you quite sure you understand, Davy?
I should be ashamed of myself if I couldn't understand the boy, or any boy.
Yes.
I don't profess to be profound, but I do lay claim to common sense.
I think, Clara, others may be better judges on such a question than you.
Oh, Edward, you are a far better judge of all questions than I pretend to be. Both you and Jane are. I only said...
You only said something weak and inconsiderate. Try not to do it again. David, I remarked that I was sorry to see you're of a sullen disposition. You must endeavour to change it. We must endeavour to change it for you.
I beg your pardon, sir. I've never meant to be sullen since I came back.
Don't take refuge in a lie, sir. You have withdrawn yourself to your own room when you ought to have been here. I require you to be here, and I require you to bring obedience here. I will have a respectful bearing towards myself and towards Jane Murdstone and towards your mother. I will not have this room shunned as though it were infected at the pleasure of a child. Sit down.
Yes, sir.
And one thing more. You are not to associate with servants. The kitchen will not improve you. Of the woman who abets you, I say nothing, since you, Clara, from old associations, have a weakness there which is not yet overcome.
Oh,
a most unaccountable delusion.
David, I disapprove of your preferring Mistress Peggotty's company. Now you understand me. If you disobey me, you know the consequences.
I knew them too well, and not just for myself. I took refuge with Peggotty no more, but sat wearily in the parlour day after day, looking forward to night and bedtime. So the holidays lagged away, until Miss Murdstone triumphantly pulled the last day off the calendar, and Mr. Barkis arrived to take me away.
Gee up!
As his cart moved off, I heard my mother calling to me.
Goodbye, Davy! My child! Goodbye!
She stood at the garden gate, holding her baby up in her arms for me to see. It was cold, still weather, and not a hair of her head, not a fold of her dress was stirred, as she looked intently at me, holding up her child. So I lost her. so I saw her afterwards in my sleep at school, a silent presence near my bed, holding her baby in her arms.
David Copperfield, I have something to tell you.
Yes, Mrs. Creakle?
When you came away from home at the end of the holidays, were they all well? Was your mama well?
My mama?
Because I grieve to tell you that your mama is very ill. She is very dangerously ill. She is dead.
There was no need to tell me so. I knew already, and felt an orphan in the wide world. I left Salem House the next day and travelled overnight to Yarmouth. A fat, short-winded, merry-looking little old man in black met me and took me to a shop that called itself Omer, draper, tailor, haberdasher, and funeral furnisher. We went into a little back parlour where three young women were at work on a quantity of black crepe.
Well, how'd you get on, Minnie?
We'll be ready by the trial on time. Never you be afraid, Father.
Oh, that's right. When I get my breath back, I'll measure this here young scholar. I've been acquainted with you a long time, my young friend.
Have you, sir?
All your life? I may say afore it. I knew your father afore you. He were 5'9½" and he lay in 25 feet of ground.
Do you know who my little brother is?
He's in his mother's arms. Oh, never you mind it, Morn. You can help my boy. Yes, the baby's dead.
I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall not die, but have eternal life.
I stood apart from the others, with Peggotty, that good and faithful servant, whom of all the people upon earth I loved the best, and unto whom my childish heart was certain that the Lord would one day say, "Well done."
She were never well for a long time, Davy. When her baby were born, I thought she'd get better, but she sunk a little every day. I think she got more timid and more frightened, like. A hard word were like a blow to her. But she were always the same to me, with my sweet girl.
How long was she very ill?
Oh, the day you went away, she said to me, "I never shall see my pretty darling again." Something tells me so. Ah. She tried to hold up after that. She never told her husband what she told me. Till one night, not long before the end, she said to him, "My dear, I think I'm dying."
I'm so tired, Peggotty. This is sleep. Sit by me while I sleep. Don't leave me.
I'll never leave you.
God bless both my children. God protect my fatherless boy. Peggotty.
Yes, my dear.
If my baby should die too.
Oh, ma'am.
If should die, please let them lay him in my arms and bury us together. Let my dearest boy
go with us to our resting place and tell him that his mother, when she lay here, blessed him not once, but a thousand times.
I will, ma'am.
His father was so good to me. When I was very giddy and foolish, he told me a loving heart was better than wisdom. And he was happy in mine. Oh, put me nearer to you.
Yes, my love.
Lay your arm underneath my neck and turn me to you. Your face is going far off. I want it to be near. I want you near.
Oh, Davy, my words come true. She were glad to lay her poor head on a stupid cross old Peckney's arm. She died like a child that had gone to sleep.
The first act of business Miss Murdstone performed when the funeral was over was to give Peggotty a month's notice. I dare say she'd have been happy if she could have given me a month's notice too. I wasn't sent back to school, but no attempt was made to give me any other education, and I was never disciplined or punished again. It seemed that all I had to fear now was neglect.
Davy, dear, I've been thinking that perhaps if they don't want you here at present, they might let you go along with me.
Oh, Peggotty, do you think they will?
Oh, here, I'll ask her now.
Ma'am, when my notice is up, I'm thinking of going to stay with my brother at Yarmouth. I wondered if Master Davy might be let go with me for a week or two.
Well, the boy will be idle there, but to be sure he'll be idle here or anywhere, in my opinion. It is of more importance than anything else that my brother should not be disturbed. I suppose I'd better say yes.
Yep.
It's a beautiful day, Mr. Barkis.
That ain't me.
Peggotty is quite comfortable now, Mr. Barkis.
Is she, though? Are you? Pretty comfortable?
Yes, Mr. Barkis.
Really and truly? You know? Are you? Really and truly pretty comfortable? Are you? Are you?
Oh, Mr. Barkis, you're that close now, Master. You've got no room. You don't want him to fall out, do you?
Oh. Beg your pardon, Master Davy. You are pretty comfortable now, though. Are you?
It was no use. He obviously thought he had hit on a way expedient for expressing himself in a neat, agreeable manner without the inconvenience of inventing conversation. At length, we arrived at Yarmouth, where Mr. Peggotty and Ham met us.
Careful with the big trunk, that's got china.
I'll take it. There we go.
Goodbye, Mr. Barker. Come in, Master Davy.
Yes, Peggotty.
Master Davy, here a minute. I say, that were all right.
Oh, yes.
That didn't come to an end there. That were all right.
Was it?
You know who's willing. That were Barkis and Barkis only.
Yes.
I'm a friend of yourn. You made it all right.
Come along, Davy. Goodbye, Mr. Barkis.
You did it. You made that all right.
What were Mr. Barkis saying to you?
He said it was all right.
That is impudence. I don't mind that. David,
What should you say if I were to think of being married?
Would you like me as much as you do now?
Oh, of course I would, my darling. Tell me what you'd say.
If you were thinking of being married to Mr. Barkis.
Yes.
I should think it would be a very good thing. You'd always have the horse and cart to bring you over to see me, and you could come for nothing.
The sense of a dear, what I've been thinking of this month back. I wouldn't give it another thought, though, as my Davy was anyways against it. Not if I'd been asked in church 30 times, 3 times over, and was wearing out the ring in my pocket.
Peggotty, look at me. You can see I'm really glad. I truly wish it.
Oh, bless you, my precious.
And now, Master Davy, how's your friend, sir?
Steerforth.
That's the name.
You said that was Rutherford.
Well, you steer with a rudder, don't you, Ham? How is he, sir?
He was very well indeed when I came away, Mr. Peggotty.
Ah, there's a friend, if you think of friends. Why, Lord, love my heart alive if it ain't a treat to look at him.
Is he very handsome?
Oh, indeed, he's very handsome, Emily. Isn't he, Mr. Peggotty?
Handsome? He stands up to you like a... Well, I don't know what he don't stand up to you like. He's so bold.
Yes, he's as brave as a lion.
And I do suppose that in the way of book learning, he'd take the wind out of almost anything.
He's very clever. And he's made a friend of me and taken me under his protection.
Ah, no, there's a friend. Do you look at Emily. She's like me. She'd like to see him.
Oh, come now.
Indeed, Emily was listening very attentively, her breath held and her blue eyes sparkling like jewels. But when I looked at her, she blushed and turned away. I still adored her, but although she liked me, she laughed at me and sometimes enjoyed teasing and tormenting me.
Emily! Emily! Wait for me!
Oh, there's yours, eh?
Why, you knew who it was. Emily?
No.
Can't I kiss you? You let me before.
I'm not a baby now.
Go away!
When it was nearly time for me to go home, it was given out that Mr. Barkis and Peggotty were going to take a day's holiday together, and little Emily and I were to accompany them. Mr. Barkis was driving a chaise instead of his usual horse and cart. The first thing we did was to stop at a church. Mr. Barkis and Peggotty went in. They were away a long time, but at last they came out, and we all drove off into the country.
Master Davy, did you see what name as I rode up on my cart?
Yes, I did. Clara Peggotty.
What name would that be as I should ride up here? Now.
Clara Peggotty again?
Clara Peggotty Barkis.
Peggotty, have you...
Yes, my dear. We've gone and got married.
Oh, Aunt Clara.
I'm very glad that's over.
When we came to the old boat that night, Mr. and Mrs. Barkis bade us goodbye and drove off snugly to their own home. I felt then, for the first time, that I had lost Peggotty. I would have gone to bed with a sore heart indeed if I hadn't been in the same house as little Emily. Oh, how I loved her. I thought what happiness it would be if we were married and went away to live among the trees and the fields, never growing older, never growing wiser, children always. The following day, Mr. and Mrs. Barkis took me home.
Whoa! Here we are, Master Davy.
Goodbye, Davy, dear.
Oh, Peggotty.
There, there, my love. Young or old, so long as I'm alive and have a house over my head, you'll find a room there for you as if I expected you directly, minute. And if you was to go to China, you might think of your room as being kept just the same all the time you was away. Better not come in. The cat wouldn't like it. Goodbye, my darling.
Goodbye, Peggotty.
It was strange to me to see the cart go, taking Peggotty away and leaving me looking at the house which had once been my home. Home. Now there was no one there but Mr. Murdstone and his sister. No one to look at me with love or liking anymore. And now, day after day, I was coldly neglected. Until at last there came a change. But it was not a happy one.
David, we have a visitor.
Hello. It's Brooks, isn't it?
No, sir. I'm David Copperfield.
Don't tell me. You're Brooks of Sheffield. That's your name.
Mr. Quinion?
That's right. I see you've got a good memory. I suppose you're a pretty sharp fellow still, eh, Brooks?
He's sharp enough. Now, David, pay attention. We have something to say to you.
Yes, sir.
You know that I'm not rich. You have received some considerable education already. Education is costly. And even if it were not, and I could afford it, I am of the opinion it would not be advantageous for you to be kept at school. What is before you is a fight with the world, and the sooner you begin it, the better. You've heard the counting house mentioned sometimes?
The counting house,
sir? At the business I am associated with, Murdstone and Grinby in the wine trade.
I know about the business, sir.
Well, Mr. Quinion manages it. He has suggested that as it gives employment to some other boys, he sees no reason why it should not, on the same terms, give employment to you. So, you are going to London, David, with Mr. Quinion, to begin the world on your own account.
In short, you are provided for and will please do your duty.
So, behold me on the morrow, in a much worn little white hat, with a black crepe round it for my mother, and my little worldly all before me in a small trunk, sitting in the post chaise that was to carry Mr. Quinion to the London coach. See how our house and church are lessening in the distance. How the grave beneath the tree is blotted out. How the church spire points upwards no more. And the sky is empty. In this manner I began my employment and my fight with the world. Murdstone and Grinby had a dirty old waterside warehouse with a wharf of its own, literally overrun with rats. A number of boys were employed to rinse and wash empty bottles. This work was my work, and of the boys employed on it, I was one. I was paid 6 shillings a week, and there seemed no possibility that I would ever be anything more than a common drudge. I felt utterly without hope, and utterly ashamed. At 12:30 on my first day, when the other boys went to dinner, Mr. Quinion called me to his office. I found there a stoutish, middle-aged person, with no more hair on his head, a large one and very shining, than an egg, and a very extensive face, which he turned full on me.
So, this is Master Copperfield. I hope I see you well.
I am very well, sir. I hope you are.
I am, thank heaven, quite well. I have received a letter from Mr. Murdstone in which he mentions that he would desire me to receive into an apartment which is at present unoccupied and is, in short, to be let as a bedroom. The young beginner who I have now the pleasure to meet.
This is Mr. McCawber.
That is my name. My address is Windsor Terrace, City Road. I live there.
Yes, sir.
Under the impression that your peregrinations in this metropolis have not as yet been extensive, and that you might have some difficulty in penetrating the arcana of the modern Babylon in the direction of the City Road, in short, that you might lose yourself, I shall be happy to call this evening and install you in the knowledge of the nearest way. At what time shall I?
At about 8.
At about 8. I beg to wish you good day. I will intrude no longer.
Mr. McCawber kept the appointment punctiliously. His house in Windsor Terrace was shabby, like himself, but, like himself, made all the show it could. Mrs. Micawber, a thin and faded lady, not at all young, sat in the parlour with a baby at her breast. There were two older children, Master Micawber aged 4 and Miss Micawber aged 3. The baby was one of twins, and I hardly ever, in all my experience of the family, saw both the twins detached from Mrs. Micawber at the same time. She came up, twin and all, to show me my room.
Do you know, Master Copperfield, I never thought before I was married, when I lived with Papa and Mama, that I should ever find it necessary to take a lodger. But Mr. Micawber being in difficulties, all consideration of private feelings must give way.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Micawber's difficulties are almost overwhelming just at present, and whether it is possible to bring him through them, I do not know. When I lived at home with Papa and Mama, I really should hardly have understood what that word meant in the sense in which I now employ it. But experientia does it, as Papa used to say. If Mr. Micawber's creditors will not give him time, they must take the consequences. Blood cannot be obtained from a stone. Neither can anything on account be obtained at present from Mr. Micawber.
Oh, that's me! I wouldn't be mean if I was you! You just play us, you hear? Swindlers! Robbers! Play us, you hear me? Play us!
Master Copperfield?
Yes, ma'am.
I make no stranger of you, and therefore do not hesitate to say that Mr. Micawber's difficulties are coming to a crisis.
I'm very sorry to hear it.
With the exception of the heel of a Dutch cheese, which is not adapted to the wants of a young family, there is not a scrap of anything in the larder. I was accustomed to speak of the larder when I lived with Papa and Mama, and I used the word almost unconsciously. What I mean to express is that there is nothing to eat in the house.
Oh, Mrs. Micawber, I have 2 shillings of my week's money left. Would a loan...
Oh, no, 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 my dear Master Copperfield. Oh, I couldn't think of it. Put them back in your pocket. But you have a discretion beyond your years and can render me another kind of service, if you will.
Please, tell me what it is.
I have parted with the plate myself. 6 tea, 2 salt, and a pair of sugars. I have at times borrowed money upon in secret. There are still a few trifles which we could part with, but Mr. Micawber's feelings would never allow him to dispose of them. Master Copperfield, if I might ask you...
Please make use of me any time you need to.
Oh, you are very kind. The twins are a great tie, and to me, with my recollections of Papa and Mama, these transactions are very painful.
Are your parents dead, ma'am?
My Mama departed this life before Mr. Micawber's difficulties commenced, or at least before they became pressing. My Papa lived to bail Mr. Micawber several times, and then expired, regretted by a numerous circle.
On this, Mrs. Micawber shook her head and dropped a pious tear on the twin who happened to be on hand. In this house, with this family, I passed my leisure time. At 10 years of age, I worked from morning till night at the warehouse, a shabby child, insufficiently fed. But for the mercy of God, I might easily have become, for any care that was taken of me, a little robber or a little vagabond. But the circumstances of my life were about to change. Mr. Micawber was arrested early one morning and taken to the King's Bench prison for debt.
Copperfield, take warning of my fate.
Yes, sir.
Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £19, 19 shillings and sixpence. Result? Happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20, aught and sixpence. Result? Misery. The blossom is blighted. The leaf is withered. The god of day goes down upon the dreary scene. And, in short, you are forever flawed, as I am.
Oh, sir.
Would you be good enough to lend me a shilling for porter? I will give you a written order on Mrs. Micawber for the amount, which will be discharged when something turns up.
Bit by bit, the household furniture was sold for the family benefit, and eventually Mrs. Micawber moved into the prison with her husband. I took the key of the house to the landlord, who was very glad to get it, and moved myself into a little room outside the prison walls. I frequently took supper with Mr. and Mrs. Micawber. By this time, they appeared to have accepted this change in their fortunes quite philosophically. Indeed, when Mr. Micawber eventually learned that he was to be released under the Insolvent Debtors Act, he was less transported by the news than I had expected.
Ah, this has been a dreadful day, Copperfield. We stand alone now. Everything is gone from us.
Sir?
The even tenor of our days is disrupted forever. Farewell, peace of mind. We must voyage into the unknown.
You're going away.
My family are of the opinion that Mr. Micawber should quit London and exert his talents in the country.
Mrs. Micawber's family have decreed that our ties with the metropolis should be wrenched asunder, that I, with my innocent dependents, should wander the face of the earth and dwell amidst the alien corn. In short, in Plymouth.
Plymouth?
Yes, Plymouth. My family having local influence there. They believe that something might be done for a man of Mr. Micawber's ability at the Custom House. They think it indispensable that he should be upon the spot.
And you go too, Mum?
I will never desert Mr. Micawber. The pearl necklace and bracelets which I inherited from Mama may have been disposed of for less than half their value. And the set of coral, the wedding gift of my papa, has actually been thrown away for nothing.
My love.
But I will never desert Mr. Micawber. It's no use asking me.
Emma, my angel, you cut me to the heart.
I will never desert you, Micawber.
My life, I am sure of it.
He is the parent of my children. He is the father of my twins. He is the husband of my affections, and I never will desert Mr. Micawber.
Oh, be calm, my love, be calm. Oh, Copperfield, my friend, I crave your indulgence.
Perhaps I should leave, sir.
Ah, discreet as ever. Indeed, I think that would be best. I must sedate Mrs. Micawber and persuade her to retire. The vicissitudes of past days have been too much for nerves strained beyond aught the delicate female constitution should be called upon to bear.
So, of course, I left them. Mrs. Micawber still sobbing hysterically in her lord's arms. It seemed our final parting was near at hand. I had grown so accustomed to them, and was so utterly friendless without them, that the thought of enduring my present life once they'd gone seemed to me unendurable. A week after his release from prison, Mr. Micawber and his family took coach for Plymouth. I met them at the coach office, and with a desolate heart, saw them take their places outside at the back.
My dear young friend, a word.
Yes, Mr. Micawber?
I am older than you, a man of some experience of life and of some experience of difficulties. At present, and until something turns up, which I may say, hourly expecting, I have nothing to bestow but advice. Still, my advice is so far worth taking that, in short, that I have never taken it myself and am the miserable wretch you behold.
Mr. Micawber.
I say the miserable wretch you behold. My advice is this. Never do tomorrow what you can do today. Procrastination is the thief of time. Collar him.
Yes, sir.
Copperfield, farewell. Every happiness and prosperity. If in the progress of revolving years I could persuade myself that my blighted destiny had been a warning to you, I should feel that I had not lived in vain. In case of anything turning up, of which I am rather confident, I should be extremely happy if it should be in my power to improve your prospects.
Master Copperfield, God bless you. I never will forget what you've done for us. You're like a son to me. Goodbye, dear Master Copperfield.
Copperfield, my friend and companion, goodbye.
Goodbye.
The coach rolled away, the Micawber family waving their handkerchiefs in farewell, and I went to begin my weary day at Murdstone and Grinby's. But I had no intention of passing many more weary days there. I had come to a resolution. I would run away and find, by some means or other, the only relation I had in the world, Miss Betsy Trotwood.
That was part two of David Copperfield from the novel by Charles Dickens. It starred Gary Cady, Harold Innocent, Sheila Hancock, Maggie McCarthy, and David Burke, with Timothy Spall, Susan Sheridan, John Moffat, Oriel Smith, Joanna Myers, Andrew Wincott, Sebastian Brennan, Terence Edmund, and Peter Tudnam. Also Nigel Carrington, Charles Millam, Ronald Herdman, Anne Windsor, Cyril Jenkins, David Bannerman, Timothy Carlton, Eric Allen, and Peter Penry-Jones. The book was dramatised by Betty Davis, and the producer was Marilyn Imrie.